Welcome to NatSec Tech, a podcast from the Special Competitive Studies Project. I'm Jean Meserve. We recorded this episode live on June 3rd at the AI Plus Expo at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center in Washington, D.C. If you've listened to this podcast before, you know that we talk a lot about the U.S.-China tech competition. It's often framed as a one-on-one contest, with the U.S. and China facing off against one another. But is there another way? In this episode, we look at working with friends and allies in the emerging technology space.
With me is Meredith Potter, the executive director of the American Security Fund. Previously, she was with the International Development Finance Corporation, USAID, the Atlantic Council, and more. Quite a resume you have. Meredith, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's fun to be recording this live at the expo.
Absolutely. What exactly is the American Security Fund? What does it do?
The fund is primarily an advocacy organization. That could be confusing because maybe of the word fund. We certainly have thoughts. If you're an investor looking to invest in the name of American security on where you should be putting that money. And also, if you're like a small AI company, maybe who's looking to sell to the government to contribute to U.S. national security for the first time, we have thoughts on that. But above all, we are in the nonprofit space. I mean, we give that advice, not for profit, really working to be part of the conversation on AI, on AI's relationship with American national security here in Washington. We have both a C3 nonprofit and a C4 that can do things like lobby the Hill. And what we're trying to convince people of is that maybe the right way to think about AI is as a three-legged stool, to invest in all three legs of the stool, to think of all three legs as related. Take away one leg, the stool falls over. And those three legs, I would say, are private AI, what industry is developing. Constantly asking the question, are we doing everything we can to facilitate American tech innovation? Two, public AI, aka government, aka constantly asking the question, are we doing everything we can to protect American tech security? And third, you know, like the wackiest leg of the stool, maybe we painted it a different color or something, is ethical AI. Asking, what are the other two legs doing? Are they doing everything they can to make sure that AI remains something humans can understand, can control, can turn off if that's how we choose to control it? And like I said, most importantly, we're trying to convince everyone that will listen to live at the intersection of those things. So trying to convince the Defense Department to invest in AI alignment, which I think would alleviate some concern about AI-enabled warfare, for example.
So can I assume then that the three legs of this stool that you've identified are not at this point working together to support the sea?
I would say not nearly as well as they could be, right? And part of the reason is because it's an innovative space. So it is rife with small AI startups who have never sold to the government before. They don't know how to navigate the DoD contracting process, which is complicated and cumbersome. And I think both industry and government aren't quite sure how to engage that professional ethicist community. Some of those folks are academics. Some of them, are bioethicists or something analogous from which we can learn. So I certainly think we could see better cooperation between the three.
Are they really part of the conversation?
I mean, obviously they are to some degree, but it seems to me those ethical conversations are far fewer.
I think that's right. And in the national security context, or as SESP says, the competitiveness context, what I would say is maybe add the word values in there. Maybe it's clearer to say we're talking about ethics and values. I mean, the third thing I would say the American Security Fund is in the form of me talking to you today, eager to have a conversation about democratic tech alliances to say, oh, you know, Taiwan is a security ally, India is an economic ally, but why is either an ally at all? That's a conversation about values, privacy, transparency, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, evidence-based information, the free flow of that information that empowers both of those freedoms. And so I think that's maybe a natural way for sort of folks who are experts in values to become a bigger part of this conversation.
So you just mentioned strengthening democratic tech alliances.
Some of these do already exist.
Yes, they do.
Let's talk about what's already in place
okay.
and what it is able to do or unable to do.
I love that. I think they exist organically. They exist bilaterally. One of the first sort of Biden era initiatives that the Trump administration decided to continue was the U.S.-India Critical and Emerging Technology Dialogue, ICET. They also exist multilaterally, or they're starting to exist more multilaterally as organizations like the Quad, U.S., India, Japan, Australia, diplomatic partnership deepen. And as groupings like the G7 and the G20 sort of take on the project of tech. But that's organic. And sometimes organic can be different than strategic. I think tech is a big word that means a lot of things to a lot of different people. And so it invites, maybe challenges us to have a more fundamental conversation than we're used to having with our allies, to have conversations that are focused on questions as fundamental as, how do you define AI? Is it the same as how we define AI? How do you define AI ethics, AI alignment? Is this the same as how we define AI ethics, AI alignment?
So I'm
trying to figure out if there's an inherent conflict here. Your organization says it's about securing American technological superiority, but then you're talking about building alliances.
Yeah.
Which means sharing.
Yep.
Does that jeopardize American superiority to share with allies?
Great question. My answer is I don't think so across the full tech stack, because across the full tech stack, I think we have different advantages. I would say that it's the difference between American innovation and Indian manufacturing. And so when my organization or when I say secure American tech superiority, I think what we mean more granularly is invest in America's competitive edge in this space, which I would say is our innovation ecosystem, which birthed Silicon Valley, which is pro-entrepreneurship and the many risks entrepreneurship requires. I think we can work within a sort of tech allied sphere to do things like build supply chains that run through those allies, makes them a little more resilient to conflict, started by a non-ally, things like that.
We're in an America First environment, though. Is there a contradiction between America First and what you're talking about?
Well, I would say a couple of things. Maybe I'll say something about like U.S. IP or exporting U.S. IP to the world. We'll say something about the American First agenda as it applies to the Indo-Pacific, just because I know I've mentioned India, Taiwan, and others. And then maybe as it applies to the rest of the world. When it comes to protecting U.S. IP, I actually think that working with allies whose legal, regulatory, financial frameworks remind us of our own, that's actually where we want American innovation to go next, to grow its business, to go global. That's where it's easiest for them to do business. You mentioned a little bit about my background. It's true, I've worked at the State Department and at USAID, may it rest in peace, and most recently at the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, DFC, which actually many people don't know about. So I'll just say DFC lends and invests in ways that would remind people more of China's Belt and Road Initiative than traditional development, not in opacity, but in tools, in lending and investment. And when I was there, I was the policy lead both for Asia and for tech, for ICT tech globally. And we made a $500 million loan, for example, to a U.S. Solar panel company. It's called First Solar, to build a manufacturing facility in India. First Solar has proprietary technology that it uses to build solar panels using cadmium telluride instead of polysilicon, so that it's creating solar panels that are actually cutting China, the world's primary supplier of polysilicon, out of its supply chain, and helping it build a manufacturing facility in India to produce tech it had invented in the United States, was producing in the United States, continues to sell in the United States, but wanted to bring to the world to grow its own company, to give others this technology. I think that's actually a good example of what we're going for, right? When you can find a partner market that you understand, it's finance, it's regulations, it's laws, you can bring that tech there. It's not where the IP was invented, but that's the story of how that IP made its way to India.
Let me ask it from the viewpoint of the other countries. Do they want to work with the U.S. at this point in time?
There's a lot of conversation about how reliable the U.S. is as an ally, whether there has to be decoupling. Isn't that conversation impacting negatively the kind of cooperation you're talking about?
Indisputably, it's impacting the conversation, and it's a perfect entree into sort of point two and three, as I described sort of what I wanted to talk about in response to your last question about sort of the America First agenda as it applies to the Indo-Pacific, which I just think is distinct so far, this far into this Trump administration, is distinct than the America First agenda as it applies to the rest of the world. In the Indo-Pacific, I would say, interestingly, President Trump and his cabinet seem to think that the America First agenda is compatible with working with allies. Very early in this administration, President Trump hosted Prime Minister Modi here. It was in that context that President Trump announced he would continue this critical and emerging technology dialogue with India. Very quickly in this administration, Vice President Vance traveled to India, gave this long speech in which he described the U.S.-India partnership as the shaper of the 21st century. That's an economic reality. That's why they have to speak about India that way. This past year was the fourth consecutive year that India was the United States' largest trading partner. India is in the midst of a manufacturing boom that is focused on tech. In March of this year, for the first time ever, Indian exports of Apple phones to the United States surpassed China's exports of Apple phones to the United States. India has a completely clean internet network because it made a national level governmental decision to do that. It has a very large, very tech literate workforce. So those are economic realities that have been reflected in what we've heard so far, both from the president and the vice president. Just this past weekend, Secretary Hegseth was in Singapore at the Shangri-La dialogue, where he said a couple of things in his public remarks. One, he announced the expansion of the U.S.-India security partnership. Two, he announced the deepening of the Quad U.S.-India-Japan-Australia diplomatic partnership. And he actually literally said America First doesn't mean America alone. There's an economic reality, as I just described it, when it comes to India. There are geographic realities. Some countries in the world are China's neighbor, and other countries in the world are not China's neighbor. Taiwan is its neighbor in a sea in which it sort of feels constantly threatened on three of its four sides, right? The Taiwan Strait, the South China Sea, the East China Sea. What I would say about not the Indo-Pacific, about the rest of the world, is that that's where I wish President Trump maybe thought that the America First agenda had a bit more alignment with working with allies, particularly democratic tech allies. Ukraine is one ally, one tech ally that I would like to see him spend a little more time sort of working to converge with. They had an interesting weekend using drones, which are sort of all things considered relatively cheap technology, hitting war planes and airfields deep in Russia. So far, I'm seeing a difference between the Indo-Pacific and the rest of the world.
You talked at length about India. Talk about Taiwan, if you would.
Yeah. Well, I would say if India is sort of our most important democratic tech ally for economic reasons, I would describe Taiwan as our most important democratic tech ally for security reasons. As I mentioned, Taiwan does have a continuous concern about physical security, and it is on three of its four borders, the Taiwan Strait to the west, the South China Sea to the south, and the East China Sea to the north. It also has a continuous concern about the relationship between its economic security and its physical security. It's been the target of economic coercion. One thing that's fun about recording this podcast live at the expo is that we're in the middle of hearing what others are saying from this booth, from stages. We're in the middle of synthesizing what we've heard. I thought one of the best talks I attended yesterday, which was the first day of the expo, was the vice president of Taiwan video conferencing into the exchange stage. And she said that for her, for the administration she serves in Taiwan, the two watchwords for Taiwan these days are resilience and freedom, or resilience in the name of freedom, resilience toward the goal of freedom. She spoke at length about economic coercion, about the need to work with allies to establish supply chains that are resilient to economic coercion, things like that.
Well, the U.S. needs Taiwan.
100%. And I'll say she spoke eloquently about the sort of feedback loop of investment between the U.S. tech ecosystem and the Taiwan tech ecosystem. Of course, her primary citation was the $165 billion investment that TSMC, the largest semiconductor company in Taiwan, has made in the state of Arizona. That would be an example of a relationship between Taiwan and the United States, semiconductor technology going back and forth that is sort of now resilient from sort of other would-be disruptors.
Not yet. We haven't got that plant built yet. That fab is not up. I have heard that India and Taiwan are cooperating with one another. U.S. is not necessarily part of that dialogue. Is that something that you find any discomfort with, or is that just fine?
How about somewhere in the middle? I would always like the U.S. to be involved because I think that our values, are inspiration to the rest of the world and can set an example for the rest of the world. So when we're not at the table, of course, there's a missed opportunity. On the other hand, I think Taiwan needs all the friends it can get. And I do think that some of that industry-to-industry cooperation is TSMC advising not on fabs, but on semiconductor assembly testing and packaging in India, from which this Indian tech manufacturing boom is benefiting. So again, I would maybe go back to what I said about the full tech stack and about being at peace with having a competitive advantage in certain parts of the tech stack. If Taiwan is giving India good advice from which they're benefiting, then that's great. But of course, we should be part of the conversation.
So alliances are government to government.
A lot of technology, of course, rests in the private sector.
Are they as keen to see cooperation?
So the private sector unapologetically is keen to grow its businesses, to
wherever
grow its profits.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And some would say that some tech companies are actually enemies of democracy.
Well, some tech companies are eager to sell to anyone who's buying in China, for example. And that is a problem from my perspective for American technological security, and is something the government is and should continue to be involved in.
Are they are not involved as much as they should be at this point in time? Is that your result?
Well, they're involved in the imposition and enforcement of export controls. I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm pro the imposition and equally the enforcement of export controls.
And do we have enough export controls in place at this point in time?
Well, I would say we're getting there. Again, this is something the Trump administration has been quick to move on. That's been interesting because they've presented it as a trade issue rather than as an AI or a tech issue. They're still in the middle of developing what they're calling their AI action plan, but they have already announced new export controls, for example, on NVIDIA's H20 chip, which was difficult to control before there was an export control on that chip in particular.
Although people have said what export controls have done is spur China to move faster.
That's certainly true to an extent because we tried to control exports of sophisticated U.S.-based chips. And by the way, there's a there because beyond TSMC and I would say Samsung in South Korea, the U.S. really is dominant in the semiconductor industry. I mean, we have Micron, we have Global Foundries, we have Qualcomm, we have Intel. And some of these companies are working with TSMC and with Samsung here and elsewhere. And nonetheless, despite export controls, we've seen successes from DeepSeek, now a sort of Chinese government relationship with DeepSeek. So yes, I think because of necessity, they've invented corollaries, just good enoughs, just what they needs. That doesn't mean we should shy away from export controls. It doesn't mean they're a bad policy tool. It means they're, I would say, a necessary but not sufficient one. It means they should be part of a broader, comprehensive tech diplomatic strategy.
And they have to be harmonized amongst allied countries.
They have to be harmonized. And this is actually, this brings us back to democratic tech alliances on a really important point. So thank you. What are our export controls? What is our export control regime if it's fundamentally different or being enforced fundamentally differently than Japan's, South Korea's, Singapore's? The vice president of Taiwan yesterday did mention export controls on the stage of the exchange, and she said something very similar. They need to be cohered amongst allies.
What about intellectual property? It has in the past somehow found its way into the hands of the Chinese in particular. How does the West protect its advancements in technology better? And is that something that the American Security Fund is involved in?
It's something we're obsessed with because in March, maybe they asked in February, but the comments were due in March. Earlier this year, when the Trump administration asked the public to submit public comments to the public record to inform its development of what it's calling its AI action plan, the first thing I was struck by was that they received 8,700 sets of comments. So if anyone who's here at the expo yesterday, today, and tomorrow was worried if AI is the thing, if you should be working in it, if you should care about it, the news is in. You should be here. You should care about it. So that was striking. But the second thing that was striking was of the companies that submitted comments, and I think of these companies as competitors, right? OpenAI and Anthropic, Google and Meta, Microsoft. But of the companies that submitted comments, they were actually rather united in the sort of two assists that they asked the U.S. government for. The first was export controls to protect what they've already invented. The second was security, both physical and cybersecurity, to protect what they're currently inventing. Microsoft called itself critical infrastructure, which has a legal meaning in government parlance. Anthropic asked the government to substantially enhance its security. OpenAI asked for intelligence and counterintelligence. Google asked for information sharing, which struck me as the same as the ask from OpenAI, but maybe in a less sort of Washington speak. And the list goes on. But all that is to say, if we feel like we're working on export controls, the two things we can do now are commit to enforcing them. And then secondly, commit to thinking of them as necessary but not sufficient and needing to be part of a broader policy approach that has got to include, as another one of its cornerstones, providing these companies with security that they have not only stood up and said they need, but they have stood up and said they are eager for the U.S. government to be the provider of. And when people ask me what's different between last year's expo and this year's expo, what's different between where AI was a year ago and where it is now, I think this is one of the fundamental differences. I feel like a year ago, companies were saying, both to government and to civil society, thank you for raising concerns about security. As we discussed earlier, thank you for raising concerns about ethics. We red team the models. We test them. We can guarantee that if you ask them how to build a biological weapon in your garage or your basement, they'll refuse to tell you. So we're all set. This year, they're so concerned about industrial espionage that they put on the public record that they're desperate for help. They know they have a problem. They know their IP is being stolen. They know it's then being, you know, manipulated.
I find it amazing that they're waking up to this now.
I know.
And it's been going on for more than a decade.
But don't you think that what we should do, given where we are, is sort of forget the fact that they're showing up to the party late and embrace the fact that they're here?
Well, you're a kinder soul than I. Do we have any questions from the audience? We've got a microphone here, and we'd love to get your input if anybody has any questions for Meredith.
You guys are talking a lot about export controls. I'm asking a question about the academic institutions now that are getting a lot of scrutiny for other reasons, but I think we have a IP loss regarding students that are coming over as a part of these big research grant teams, and then they're failing five or six times throughout their, you know, 4 or 6 year time here supporting those efforts, but then they're going back and taking those failures with them to, you know, China and some of the other countries that are heavily involved in these academic institutions. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, and many of them return to China and found their own companies. If I could recommend a book to everyone that listens to this podcast, it's called The Trans-Pacific Experiment by Matt Sheehan, who I think now works at the Paulson Institute. But the subtitle of the book is literally focused on the relationship between California specifically, Silicon Valley specifically, and China. And he calls this something like the Google effect or the Google phenomenon, that it's sort of honorable in the Chinese system. Ever since President Xi announced a national plan for AI, particularly in families that are products of the one child generation, where parents and grandparents have an active role in charting the career, the life of the individual in question, it's become a matter of honor. It's become an incredibly honorable pursuit to come to the U.S. to study, to work specifically at Google, and then to go back to China and to found a company. I don't have a good answer on what to do at the university level about that problem, but I do think that government intelligence, counterintelligence, information sharing, everything that companies asked for in these 8,700 sets of comments to the White House is the solution in the Google chapter of the story, right? The student comes here, they maybe get a degree at one of our universities. They don't always go back at that point, which is one of Matt's arguments, having dug into sort of how long they stay, what the nature of their visa is, et cetera. They work at a Google for 5 years, 7 years. They learn how that company works, and then they go home. And I think at that level, there's a lot the U.S. government can do to help Google that we're not doing, that a year ago Google didn't necessarily want.
And of course, it isn't just Google.
You're using that as an example. Yeah, you're totally using that as an example.
And so they're saying they're going to scrutinize student visas from China much more carefully than they have in the past. Good step, in your opinion?
I understand the logic of it. The logic of it was articulated in the premise of the question. Perhaps as with every policy, I think it will depend on implementation. It's a really good example of a policy where you want to balance, you know, that we do want to provide students an education wanting to keep our technology secure. But by the way, wanting to keep our technology secure, not out of charity, not for fun, but as I said, to protect our competitive advantage, which I really think is our innovation ecosystem.
Do you believe that a democratic tech alliance of the type you've discussed can ever compete with the China, Russia, Iran, North Korea access? We see them sharing technology now.
Well, you're ending with a downer of a question, I have to say, but it's a well-founded one. I'm worried about it. I think the Democratic Tech Alliance is the only way we can compete with what I would call the authoritarian tech alliance. One of the things the vice president of Taiwan said from the stage of the exchange yesterday was she described it as the authoritarian toolbox. She said the authoritarian states are sharing their toolbox. They're pulling from the same toolbox. And so, of course, her recommendation was that democratic countries do the same, share our toolbox and pull from the same toolbox. I would add, if I could slap a label on the side of that toolbox, I would label it hybrid threats. Because what I'm watching, what I'm concerned about them sharing lessons learned, perfecting how to do, are the equivalent of playing like the four or the five in your hand of cards, not the equivalent of playing your ace. Things like cyber incursions, telecom incursions, including in, harming or dismantling undersea cables, which is becoming increasingly common, which is becoming increasingly concerning, disinformation, things like that. So that's what I think as a democratic tech alliance we should be paying attention to. We should be investing in countering. We should be investing in deterring. And then I think I cannot conclude an answer to this question without acknowledging the relationship the special relationship of all the countries you mentioned between China and Russia. In the tech space, I am very concerned. Asia watchers have been concerned for a while that China's support for Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which really has become a war of tech, a war about tech, will create reciprocal expectations for Russian support of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. I don't know. I'm not in the business of reading the tea leaves of Xi Jinping. What an incredibly difficult person to psychoanalyze. So I don't know that that reciprocal expectation has increased the probability of an invasion of Taiwan, but I think it's raised the stakes of an invasion of Taiwan. So I'm watching that too.
Meredith Potter, Executive Director of the American Security Fund. Thank you so much for joining us here at the AI Plus Expo.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for watching and listening. I'm Jean Meserve. Take care.